We're here in Brachos on Daf Zayinim and Beis, and we're taking a look at the Agadah about names. We discussed the name Reuven, and Leah declares Reuven ma beni ben beni leben chami. And here Reuven is given a lot of credit, because even though the Bechara was taken away from him and transferred over to Yosef, nevertheless, he did not harbor jealousy, resentment against Yosef. He was the one who stepped forward to save Yosef. Now, what I'd like to go through with you is a piece here in Rav Kook, of course, in the Ein Raya. And this is number Ayin Tess on page 34. And he presents the thesis that Reuven, insofar as he was the Bechar, he represents an attribute of the entire Klal Yisrael. The Bechar is the one who paves the way for the entire family, in this case, for the entire family of Israel. And in a certain sense, he says we can compare Reuven to Klal Yisrael. He says, "Tchunoso be'erach shar ha'umos ke'erach Reuven ha'bechor neged shar ha'bonim." To the extent to which Reuven represents all of the brothers, the entire family, we can compare and contrast Reuven with Esav. And in that sense, we are comparing all the brothers, the Shiftei Kah, Klal Yisrael, to the other umos. What is the attribute of Reuven that reflects on the singular nature of Klal Yisrael? As we said, he is the Bechor, is the representative of Klal Yisrael. And in this context, the way we see Leah declaring Reuven, his greatness, is that he's over Al Pesha. Meaning, in a sense, somebody usurped his Bechorah. And we would anticipate that he would snap back and attack out of a sense of, you've trespassed, you've entered into my space, you've taken away something of mine. And instead, he wants to do good, even for those who inadvertently, if not intentionally, caused him suffering. And that he doesn't do. He overcomes that natural tendency of every human being to fight back against someone who threatens him. And this is the difference between Klal Yisrael and the nations of the world. We know that the nations of the world are jealous of the Jewish people because of some special nature of the Jewish people, some yitaron, some advantage that the Jews have. What is primarily this advantage? It's not finances, it's not good looks, it's not large families, and it's not even their intellectual brilliance. But we're talking about ma'alot ha'nefesh, something in the soul, that sensitive soul of the Jew that separates the Jew and uplifts him to a higher level. And generally speaking, this comes to the Jewish people as a matter of free choice. They decide to leave behind them the bad ways, the evil ways, and instead move forward in the right way, the righteous way. And therefore, the Umos HaOlam actively will sell their Bechorah, because the Bechorah represents that aspect of being willing to give up on something, and that the Umos are not willing to do. They are, in Rav Kook's language, shtufim b'taivos. They are dedicated to the pleasures of this life. That's what's primary for them. And therefore, other advantages that belong more to the intellectual, spiritual realm don't interest them. That's not primary focus on their list. Klal Yisrael, on the other hand, are interested in the righteous path. And as a result, what we end up with in this very sharp conflict between the Umos and Klal Yisrael is Vayistom Esav. Esav harbors enmity, hatred against Yaakov. But the Jewish people, in contrast, even when we are near Dafim, we are victimized. When they take away our rights to Bechora, and that means they take it from our children as well, and even when the Umos Olam undermine us and exile us from our land with tremendous cruelty, despite it all, the eyes of the Jew are turned towards Hashem to bring about for all the creatures on the world, on the earth, all the nations of the world, the day in which the nations will see the light, they will appreciate the way of Hashem, they will have knowledge of God and dedicate themselves to the service of God. And our eyes are so nisuot, as we say, are turning towards heaven, not because of any need for nekama, for revenge, but rather, as we say in Olenu, at the very end of our davening, lahafnose lecha kol rishei haaretz, that the evildoers of the world should look towards you, God. Yakiru v'yedu, they should recognize and acknowledge Kol Yoshvei Tevil Ki L'chotich Rakol Berech L'choti Shaval Kol Lashon. So instead of reacting in what would be a natural sort of response that we can anticipate, we can expect, no, Klal Yisrael doesn't respond with a desire for revenge, you know, beat down the enemy. That's not it. Our desire is that the members of the human race, of mankind, should open up their eyes and recognize Hashem and dedicate themselves to the avod of Hashem. It's an amazing, glorious trait of the Jewish people. We see it right here in the Bechor in Reuven, in terms of his response to Yosef and his relationship to Yosef. But in general, the Gemara says that names have meaning, significant meaning. Rus, for example, a name that was given to her before she converted, and yet remained her name throughout, and the Megillah is called Megillas Rus, one of the books of Kisvei HaKodesh, and the name Rus has to do with Shiros V'Tishbachos. She is the mother of David HaMelech, the Ne'im Zemiros Yisrael. And even though the story of Rus begins with Naomi, and at the face of it we would think that Naomi is the main persona in this story, and she should gain the name of the Megillah, should be Megillas Naomi. No. Once Naomi steps aside, Rus moves forward central stage. She becomes the Ikar, the primary subject and theme of the book of Rus. And from Rus is going to come David HaMelech, who's going to author Sefer Tehillim, the greatest collection, shall we say, of religious poetry and praise to Hashem. So the fact that the name Rus, which offhand should have been replaced by some sort of a Hebrew name, because Rus was the name given to her before she converted to Judaism, but nevertheless it remains her name, the Megillah is called by that name, and Rus has tremendous significance. And we mentioned last time that the Gemara in Yuma tells a story about Rabbi Meir, how Rabbi Meir was very careful about names, he would be medayik bishmo, and he would learn things about a person. And sometimes the name itself is a very good omen for what's going to happen down the line in the future. Again, we emphasized with a lot of presentation here about the mission in Ovas, HaKol Tzafui V'Rashus Nesuna, the presentation of the Ein Yaakov here, that we should never think that because of the name, we are robbed of our freedom of choice. The Gemara asks me, Nolan, is there a source? There must be a source for the Shema Gorim, for the fact that a name has meaning and can project a person's future. And the Gemara bases it on a pasuk in Tehillim, and the pasuk in Tehillim speaks about the Mif'olos Hashem Asher Sam Shamos Baritz. And Shamos means Shmama, destruction. But as the Marsha points out here, we don't believe that Hashem, the source of destruction, man has to be playing this role. So we reinterpret the word Shamos by changing the vowels and the pronunciation to Shamos. And Shamos means that we should realize that there's something in a name. What's in a name? Yes, there is something in a name. And when a person is born, those who give him his name, his father, his mother, the name that comes dawns upon them, and they entertain in their mind, that's not coincidental. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu who's guiding them and giving them that name to give to the child. And Rav Kook quotes the Balei HaKabbalah who say that there really is no pure accident in all of reality. And that means the entire universe, but especially particularly in the case of man, in what befalls man during the course of his lifetime, what might seem at the surface level to be part of the accidents of nature is not a mikra. There is no mikra. Or there may be a mikra, but not a mikra gomor. Everything with regard to man is meant to bring man to a state of seichel, and nothing is coincidental. If we look at the overall system of the universe, the harmony within the universe, then things that happen really encompass past, present, and future, all time zones. And especially in the case of giving a name to a person, that name giving is not left to freedom in the pure sense, but the name rather has to be appropriate for what's going to happen down the future. And sometimes, and especially in the case of important individuals who have an impact on the entire world, you can see with a clear recognition how the name affects, you know, the future, a Reuven or a Rus. But with regard to your rank and file person, it's not very easy to figure out how the name causes the future. And the way Chazal darshan this Asher Sam Shamos Baritz, the word Shamos Baritz, is a very fascinating drasha, because the deeper meaning of Chazal is that Shamos, which means destruction and desolation, this is Kilkul and Churban, these are things that we can always attribute to accident. You know, there were terrible tornadoes and earthquakes and who knows what. But when we see building, there's a design, there's a purpose. This is already not accidental, this is deliberate. The chiddush here of the Gemara is that even Shamos, which at the ostensibly we respond by saying Shamos is something that just happened, you know, it's built into nature, and sometimes it's catastrophic. But there's not kilkul mukhlat, there's no absolute desolation. Even things that seem so destructive and so catastrophic become the seeds from which grows goodness, and sometimes even the greatest goodness. The language is very flowery. He says, "Al yidei kilkulim hayoter noraim titzmachna hatovot hayoter gedolot." And once that happens, and we see greatness that comes from catastrophe, then it becomes clear retroactively that Hashem was acting even in the Shamos. It wasn't coincidental, but it was part of a divinely inspired plan. And the name that a person is given has to be appropriate, has to fit with all the repercussions of that man's life down the line. And we should realize, although it's below the surface, it's concealed, that the name that was given is meant to teach us something about the future. We may have to wait until that future comes into reality to be motzi min hakoach al hapoel, that which is concealed and hidden, inherent in the name, but ultimately we'll see there'll be a horah that will tell us what that name really foretells. What I want to do with you now is the statement in the Gemara on the bottom of Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, and the Gemara tells us in the name of Rabbi Yossi, called Dibur V'Dibur Shiyotza Mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Tova Afilu Al Tnai Lo Chazar Bo, that whenever God promises something, even though there was a condition, and even though that condition was never fulfilled, nevertheless, the divine promise will come to fruition. And the Gemara derives this, if you recall, from Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moshe prayed on behalf of Klal Yisrael in the aftermath of the Egel, Hashem's response was, Heref mimeni vashmideim v'asel uschol agoy atzum v'rav mimenu. And Moshe indeed became the ancestor of multitudes. Lahoros she'ein kilus b'chuko milehetiv l'chol amuchat. There's no stinginess in God's, in the way God operates in this world, His desire to be metiv, to bestow good on anyone who is prepared, who has done all the necessary preparations to receive divine goodness. But if the recipient is not prepared, you know, he's not on the level, then it's not going to happen. So when Chazal say that Yotza Dibur L'Tova, what it means is that Hashem said, you know what, I'm going to bestow good on you because you're ready and you're on the level to receive that goodness. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will definitely bestow the goodness, because there's always a desire and a movement towards bestowing goodness as long as the recipient is ready for it. He's mukhan, he's prepared. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu made his pronouncement and his promise, obviously at that moment in time the recipient was prepared. Now, the tnai that Hashem made, the condition in this goodness, in bestowing this goodness, has to relate to something other than the chisaron in the hachonas hamakabel. Let me explain. When Hashem says to Moshe, heref mimeni, and I'm going to destroy the Jewish people, even though Moshe Rabbeinu undermined and voided that divine threat, and it never would come to fruition, nevertheless, when Hashem says, Escha oscha l'goy gadol, the nullification of the condition has nothing whatsoever to do with Moshe Rabbeinu's preparedness to receive that goodness. However, if Hashem would express a divine promise, and a contingency, the tnai, is that the recipient be prepared, that he deserves to receive that goodness, hechsher amaseh, he has prepared himself, then the tnai becomes so fundamental, and without the achonas hamakabel, without the makabel being prepared, the goodness is not going to be bestowed. Because, again, the goodness comes because of the achana and the hechsher of the recipient. So Moshe Rabbeinu is an excellent example of Kol Dibra V'Dibra Afilo HaTanai, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Mekayim, even though the Tanai wasn't Mekayim, Hashem lives up to that statement, because even though the condition of destroying the Jewish people never came to fruition, but that has nothing to do with Moshe Rabbeinu's Hachana, he was Muchan, and if he was Muchan, Hashem wants to be Meitiv, and will never rescind the promise of HaTovah. Amar Rav Yochanan, back in the Gemara here on Daf Zayin on the base, and we're in the wide lines, and we're on the fourth of the wide lines. The Gemara says, Amar Rav Yochanan, Mishum Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, Ben Yochai, Koshe Tarbus Ra, Besof Beso Shal Onam, Yoser, Mimilchemes Gog Ugmogog. You know, if we have to think of the greatest cataclysmic and catastrophic event in human history down line, it's going to be Gog Ugmogog. But yet, there's something even more painful and more catastrophic to a person in his own life beyond the Milchama of Gog Ugmogog. And that is Tarbus Rabatov Beso. Tarbus is the language of teaching, of raising, of gidul. And when you raise a child, and chas v'shalom, the child goes off to tarbus ra, he becomes a chote, and all your training goes to naught and was unsuccessful, that is the greatest anguish of them all. And the Gemara uses the case of Avshalom as the source for this statement of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. And the Gemara is going to compare the words of David HaMelech regarding his son Avshalom to the words of David HaMelech regarding Milchemes Gog Umagog. In the former case, Mizmar LeDavid B'Barcho Mifnei Avshalom B'No. Again, we're going to come back to that word Mizmar a little bit later on, but first, this chapter in Tehillim, the third chapter in Tehillim, is dedicated to the response of David the father when his son Avshalom rises up against his father in rebellion. And right there at the very beginning of this Perek in Tehillim, Ksiv Basrei, it says right away, Hashem Marabu Tzoroi Rabim Kamim Olai. When he speaks about Avshalom and the revolution of Avshalom, it's Ma Rabu Tzorai. It's a very harsh language. My son has transformed himself to be my enemy. And David calls that Rabu Tzorai, Ribui Tzoros. It's an intense, we're not just talking in quantitative terms, we're talking in qualitative terms, Ribui Tzoros. Now it's interesting that David HaMelech uses the plural here when he says Rabim kolim alai. So you look at the Mitzudas David and he points out that Avshalom was not alone in this rebellion against David. There were great people who were outstanding in Chachmah who were also rising against David, and that's Doeg, Achitofel, Shimi ben Gera. Now, that pasuk of Rabu Tzorai does not reappear, or anything as harsh or like it, with regard to Milchemes Gog Umagog. Because there, David HaMelech says, Lama Rakshu Goyim Ulamim Yegu Rik. In other words, what purpose do the nations have when they join together and unite to battle against the people of Israel? But the language of Rabu Tzorai, Mar Rabu Tzorai, Loksiv, that doesn't appear. In other words, Milchemes Gog Magog, relative to Avshalom, is sort of lightweight. Rashi adds, Ma Toelis Lahem Almadover Kalhu Bienov. Not only does David HaMelech omit the words Rabu Tzorai when he talks about the nations who unite against the Jewish people, In addition to omitting Rabu Tzarai, he uses a language of Lama Rakshu Goyim, which means, as Rashi says, Ma Toeles Ilohem. They're gaining nothing. So, in a certain sense, David HaMelech is, you know, Mach Mitahant, you know, as we say in Yiddish. He waves it away with regard to Melchemes Gog u'Magog. But what is most absolutely severe is his response to Avshalom, which is called Tarbus Ra. And this was Rav Shimon Bar Yochai wants to teach us here, that a person has to know that when he prays to Hashem, what should be primary on his list of petitions would be that there should not be Tarbus Ra'a B'Toch Beiso.
Azariah?
Mefarshim are bothered. Why is this called Tarbus Ra'a B'Toch Beiso? The story, the episode of Avshalom, that confrontation is much more than just Tarbus Ra'a. This is a Melchama. It's a great Melchama. In fact, Avshalom had his eyes set on catching David and destroying David. And they gave him an Eitzah, Ahitofel gave him an Eitzah, how to do this and how to succeed in destroying his father. But it seems that David was not impressed by that fact and that description of reality. He was very calm about it. He had in his back pocket a security, a promise that no doubt that Avshalom would not kill him. And this dates back to the promise of the Navi, of Nosan HaNavi, Gam Hashem Hevir Chatosecha Lo Samus, meaning that Avshalom would not destroy David. That's inherent in this divine promise through the Navi Nos. What Rav Shimon ben Bar Yochai is telling us is, even if David had a secure divine promise that he would not be killed by Avshalom, but the most difficult, anguished thing was Tarbus Ra'a B'Toch Beiso. And that's greater than the worst Milchamas. Just like David knew that Milchamas Gog u'Magog would not be Matzliach against the Jewish people, and this is based on a prophecy of Yechezkel, David also knew that Avshalom would not destroy him. But his Ribui Tzara that he's referring to is the fact that his own son rebelled against him. That's the Tarbus Ra'a B'Toch Beiso Shalom. And here the Mefarshim raise another objection. The Gemara tells us later on in Brachos, on Daf Nun Dalet, Chayev Adam Levarach Al Ra'a Kishem Shu Mevarach Al Tova. And if that be the case, should David's response to this terrible calamity of Avshalom rising up against him be one of bracha? To respond to Ra'a with bracha? And from the next line in the Gemara, you get the impression that the answer is no. Because look at the Gemara says. The Gemara says, Mizmar l'David b'barcha b'nei Avshalom b'no. The chapter opens up with Mizmar. And the Gemara is amazed by this. Mizmar l'David. Kina l'David mipoile. It should be a lamentation. David HaMelech's response should have been one of grief. Why does this chapter in Tehillim open with Mizmar l'David? And before we see the Gemara's answer, the question that we want to raise is, regarding the very premise of this question, wouldn't this premise be contradicted by the principle in Halacha of Mevarchim ala Ra? And the Meloah Reim in his Hagos answers that although a person is obligated to respond to Ra with a certain level of Simcha, that's only after the Ra'a is complete. There's no possibility of rectifying it. However, when the decree is out there, but yet the evil has not been implemented, has not come to fruition yet, a person has to respond with tefillah, with bechi, with tainis, to try his hardest to nullify that decree. And the Gemara says that as long as David was a fugitive, running away from Avshalom, he should have been involved in kina, meaning in crying out to Hashem, in tefillah, please, Hashem, save me. Do something that would change Avshalom. And then we'll see the Gemara's answer. Now, I just want to give, before we see the Gemara's answer, a little bit of background to the story of Avshalom, as it's recorded in the Novi and Shmuel Beis, and starts with Perek Tesvav. Avshalom rose up in rebellion against David, against his father, and he gathered around him a large multitude of followers that joined his camp, and amongst them was David HaMelech's main counsel, Achitophel. And Achitophel himself was the one who gave Avshalom the advice that when David and his people had to leave Yerushalayim, that Avshalom would be recommended, well, it would be well a well-thought-out plan for him to take 12,000 men, run after David during the nighttime, when David is absolutely exhausted from the entire day of running away, and he'll be able to destroy the king and all of David's followers. Now, David preempted this by sending Hushi Ha'archi that he should join the camp of Avshalom and try to vitiate the council of Achitophel. This Hushi counseled Avshalom, it's not a good idea, as Achitophel told you, because David's men are very powerful, and who says you'll succeed and destroy them? Therefore, it's a better idea to wait until you can gather together the entire nation, and then you can certainly destroy David and his people. And somehow, HaKadosh Baruch Hu miraculously caused it such that Avshalom would accept this eitz of Hushi, and instead of going out to battle against David during the nighttime, as Achitophel suggested, he would wait until he could fill his troops and buffer his offensive. That's the word I wanted to use. Now the story gets a little bit more complicated when Hushi tells Tzadok and Avyasa, these are the Kohanim, what Achitophel was counseling Avshalom. They in turn, that's Tzadok and Avyasa, sent Yonasan and Achimaatz to notify David about the eitz of Achitophel. When David finds out about the eitz of Achitophel, he runs and crosses the Yarden, and he prepares his people to battle against Avshalom and his and Avshalom's people. And at the end of the day, David HaMelech and his people fight that battle, and they're victorious. Many, many Jews died in that battle, and Avshalom himself was killed in that battle. But this is just to get a broader picture from the perspective of the Nach of what was going on in David's life and how much anguish he suffered as a result of the Tarah B'Zerah of his own son Avshalom. And now let's look at the concept of Mizmar LeDavid. Gemara says, Om Rabbi Shimon ben Avishalom, Mashal Amad Dover Domen. We have to give a mashal to understand why David uses the word Mizmar when his son Avshalom is rebelling against his own father. Mashal Yodam Shiyotzalav Shtar Chof. Somebody produces a document that testifies that this person owes money. Kodem Shepro Hayatzev. As long as the defendant here, the so-called borrower, has not yet paid back his money, he is sad, he's nervous. Liacha Shepro, but once he pays back his chov, Sameach, he's absolutely happy. And the reason for his happiness, obviously, is the fact that he was successful in paying back his chov. What's the nimshal? Af kein David. David had a chov to pay up. Because earlier in Shmuel Beis, in Perkut Beis, David gets a very harsh divine promise, or shall we say prophecy. Shabbat HaKadosh Baruch Hu, hineni, make him alecha ra'a mi beisecha. That as a punishment for your crime, David, Hashem promises that there will be evil perpetrated against you, mi beisecha, from amongst your offspring. And at that point, David haya atzev, David was very depressed. Why? Amar, he declared, Shema, eved omam zerhu, maybe I have some sort of a child, or some individual is going to rise up against me in my household, who's an eved, who's a mamzer, and such a person will have no compassion on me whatsoever. When he finds out that the fulfillment of this divine Ra'ami Beisecha is going to be his own son, Avshalom, is Samach, he is happy, Umishim Hachi, Omar Mizmar, instead of Akina, he says Mizmar. And the Mefarshim try to expand and elucidate on this explanation of Rav Shimon ben Avishalom to understand what the nature of David's Simcha is. And in order to appreciate what they say, let's formulate a question here on the Gemara. Because sometimes you have one question, you ask another question, it helps. When David saw that the evil that would befall him as a fulfillment of this divine promise would be through his own son, why was he happy? After all, Avshalom was ready and eager to kill his father. And that's clear in the Navi. As we said before, Achitophel gave Avshalom a counsel to kill David, how to do it successfully. And David was aware of this. He got word of that counsel of Achitophel. And he indeed declares, Hine b'ni asher yotza mimei mevakesh es nafshi. So David was fully aware of the fact that Avshalom was out to kill him. And if not for divine intervention, Avshalom would have accepted the counsel of Achitophel and gone out to kill David, and he would have been successful at night. And Achitophel and Avshalom would show no compassion whatsoever for his father. So what does this mean when David sighs a sigh of relief and even expresses a joy at the fact that it's his own son, his legitimate son Avshalom, who's going to rise up against him, because his own son would certainly have compassion? Chayes Aleh, to use the Gemara's term, well, that's not true at all. And the Rasha suggests the following, that even though it's not clear from the Pesukim that Avshalom had any sort of compassion on his father, but on the contrary, it's all it indicates in the Pesukim is that Avshalom wants to kill his father, but David, in his own mind, was convinced that Avshalom would eventually have compassion on him. That's the Marsha's approach. So we're talking not about the truth and the reality, we're talking about the perception of David. In David's perception, there was reason to dance and be joyful, because in David's understanding, Avshalom would never kill him. Now, I want to present to you a slightly alternative approach to this sugya. We mentioned the Marsha, Rabbi Yonasan Ivashitz, in his Sefer Avos Yonasan, has a different take. He says that when we talk about Din Shamayim, meaning a punishment that comes from the divine heavenly court, it falls under two categories. there's one kind of punishment that is meant to cleanse a person, refine him and purify him from his sins. There's another category of punishment in which God simply says, I'm not involved anymore. He removes kaviyachol his hashgacha, and now the individual is going to receive whatever is in the natural order of the universe, whatever is in causality. There won't be any kapara of his averos. And if a person wants to ask the question, well, how do I know? You know, is it this category or is it that category? Is it suffering that's being brought upon me as a kapara to elevate me, to refine me? Or is it simply God says, you know what? I'm going to leave you to nature. And there's no kapara element here at all. Says Rav Yonah Sanaivishitz, you have to look, you have to analyze at the tsuras haperonios. Look at the way or the shape, the form of the suffering, and you could recognize if this suffering is a result of a divine decree that's being brought upon a person as part of a process of refinement, of atonement. Or, on the contrary, is it simply that Hashem is removing his hashgacha and allowing man to suffer from teva, from the natural order of the universe? You can tell by analyzing the way the suffering came about. If the tzara, if the suffering came about through natural order, it's something that you could almost anticipate, then unfortunately what's happening here is Hashem has removed his special divine providence and protection over you, and he's allowing you, he's throwing you to the dogs to suffer the tzaros of teva. However, if the tzaros look totally different than that, you can't anticipate them. They don't express a cause and effect natural order of the universe. It's shalokid derech hateva. There's something that just defies and undermines the natural law, that it must be that it's coming from Hashem. And it's hashgacha, and it's meant to be mechaper on a person's averos. And here's where David says the following. How will this make him olecha rabi beisecha be fulfilled? If it's going to be from an eved or a mamzer, well, you know what? You can almost anticipate that such people would have absolutely no compassion. And you can predict the evil based on the natural law. There's nothing unusual about it. Hashem is just removing his hashgacha. But if, as David discovers, it's Avshalom, his own son, who wants to kill him, that undermines, that's a fluke, that cannot be explained in the natural order of the universe. It's Shalom Kederach HaTeva. And that's what makes David happy, because now he realizes this is all part of divine plan. This is all meant to bring atonement for David, for his sins. And therefore, Omar Mizmar, he declares, this is my song of praise, Al Kaparas Avonos, because I'm experiencing a great divine compassion that's going to bring atonement for my sins. Now, at this point, what I'd like to do with you is jump over to the Ein Ayah, and he says the following: Kosher Tarbus Ruah B'Toch Peso Shel Adam Yeshkan Ha'ora Protis Uklolus. There are two comments and insights that we should derive from this statement of Rav Shim Bar Yochai. Number one, Protis, on a personal individual level, this Amalek business is symbolic of those opponents and enemies of a person that are external to a person, that are his worst enemies and desire his evil. But then, and excuse me, let me add to that, included in that category are the powers of Teva, the general powers of Teva. For example, the weather conditions, you know, sometimes bring about catastrophes, changes in time and climate, etc., etc. And those external forces against a person who try to do a person under are not as bad as a different kind of oppressor, so to speak. The real problem, you can always try to protect yourself, be more careful against anything that's external, and take the proper precautions, or gather together a strong army to fight the other army. But sometimes, the opponent that's trying to bring you down is internal, not external. It's the Yetzer Hara. It's the desire for unbridled pleasure that's within a man. Those are the mashchisim. Those are the forces that destroy a person, his body and his soul, on a continuous basis. And they require a level of shmira to be careful that goes way beyond all the external forces. Because a man is karavei talatzmo. You know, this is very difficult for a person. Now let's okay. So that's number one on a personal level. Now let's jump ahead to the second insight, and that's in terms of Klal Yisrael as a nation, a collective entity. And Yosef Imasha Herulano Oyvenu Achitzonim, one would certainly assume that would be a knee-jerk response to the question of who or what is our greatest enemy as a nation. Certainly it would be our enemies that surround us. But no, there's something even worse. And that is Tarvus Ra, what we call the Erev Rav. There's a force within the Jewish nation itself that undermines the Jewish nation. And even if you compare these enemies from within, because the Tarvus Ra of the Erev Rav and the like, you will find that they are relatively limited in number compared to the forces of the enemies around us, external to us. Nevertheless, despite the smaller numbers, despite the more limited quantity, but on a qualitative level, in terms of Echus, they are much more powerful. Yecholim lifgoa biyoser. They could really undermine us because they were part of our inner being. This is the Tarbus Ra. We have accepted a certain way of life, a certain way of thinking, a worldview that we've, by osmosis, we have taken it in from the outside. And that is the Erev Rav from within us. And why is this Pagia even more powerful, even more dangerous, with far-reaching repercussions? Because who matil sino ben Yisrael avinu shebashamayim. You know, as long as we're facing our external enemies, God is on our side. But when we are facing our internal enemies, and these forces are subduing us and succeeding victoriously in subjugating us, then we lose our intimate relationship with our Father in heaven. We undermine our faith as an intellectual comprehension of God. We undermine our attributes, our ethical standing. And that's the most dangerous part. That's kasha, tar bisra, besoch, beso shalod. The pasuk, however, in Yeshaya, at the very beginning, promises us, ve'etzov, kvar sigayich, vasira kol b'dilayich, yikra lecha irat tzedek. Hashem says, I will refine you, and I will purify you of all this rotten evil from within, and then you will inherit Yerushalayim, the Ir HaTzedek. In the next piece, we learned about Mizmar LeDavid, And we saw that Rav Shimon gave a mashal with a shtar chov and how happy a person is when he is capable of repaying his debt. And David HaMelech is happy about the fact that Avshalom is going to be the means to repay his debt, because it's his own son and he would certainly have compassion on his father. The relationship between the mashal and the nimshal, if one is meant to be a corresponding mirror image of the other, is a little bit difficult. It's a loose connection, because in the case of the mashal, a person is certainly happy when he has the wherewithal to pay back his chov, but the implication is that he owed 1,000, he paid 1,000. In the nimshal, in the case of David HaMelech, he does get a piran, you know, he does actually pay up, but you know, he only pays a fraction of his chov. He should have suffered so much more so through an eved and a mamzer. Hashem let him off easy with a what we call a light punishment and said, you know what, you'll get your own son Avshalom who's going to be against you. You know, a more precise mashal would have been if, let's say, you borrowed $1,000 and the lender says to you, you know what, you only have to pay me back 500, I'll be mochel on 500. And here HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, instead of having this eved or this, you know, this mamzer who's totally resentful and full of hatred against you and has no compassion whatsoever, I'll give you an enemy that has some element of compassion. Pay back 500 instead of 1,000. But that doesn't seem to be the case of the mashal. And perhaps, you know, the words here that are giving us a problem are Afkan, David, etc. Now, maybe the Afkan, David is a misprint, and it should have been Aleph Chaf Dalid, the first letter in each of those three words, and should be read as Ika Diamri. Or maybe there was a text that said Ika Diamri. It's not clear. But in any event, the text of the Gemara as we have it, Afkan David, is problematic because it's not really an Afkan David. There's no parallel. But be that as it may, when we analyze the mashal itself, a person doesn't want to have to pay back a chov if he could avoid it. He's a little bit of, you know, anxious, if not, that's an understatement, about paying back the chov. And that anxiety is the source really for his simcha when he actually pays it back. Meaning the simcha sort of like undermines all that nervous tension that he had. Will I be able to pay back the chov? David's case is a bit different. David is the paradigm of someone who accepts the divine decree out of a sense of love. The piron, you know, it's the paying back of the onesh that Hashem promised him that there would be a rabbi beso. That for David, from David's perspective, is not a heavy weight over his shoulders. You know, again, in the mashal, you know, imagine the heavy weight and the pressure of having to pay back an enormous humongous chov. Here, David HaMelech is perfectly happy to pay back his chov, because that's going to bring him kapara. So therefore, in the case of David HaMelech, the simcha is not the paying back the chov. So it would not be accurate or appropriate to say that mizmar, which reveals a simcha, the feeling of a simcha, would be the fact that he doesn't have to pay back the chov, because even before the payment of the chov, it's not true to say that was difficult, that was weighing David down. He wants to pay back his chov. And therefore, it would be more likely to suggest that whatever the divine decree was, David accepted it with love, and therefore that wasn't weighing heavily on him even before he paid it back. The simcha of the piron as a general universal concept, removing a masui, is not really appropriate here, because again, the simcha is not that there was a piron, but the simcha was that there will be a piron. Meaning, the fact that Hashem is giving him a decree, and that itself incurs the ava of David HaMelech to accept that decree, because David HaMelech understands and appreciates that Hashem's decree is for his benefit, is going to be a kapar for his avera. But rather, the issue here is something a little bit different. David was afraid of an eved or a mamzer. And there's a principle in the Chachmei HaKabbalah, in the Zohar, that Baal Bechira, Yuchal Lahara Lefamim Yoser Mikfi HaNigzar, Afi Shavadi HaKol Yesh Cheshbenu Mishpat, Mikomakom Ein Mechmakom Kol Kach LeKabul Bi'ava, Kevon Shesof Sof Ein Zeh Hosofa Me'ikar HaGzera Hel Yonah. Which means that there are situations in which a person abuses his freedom of choice and perpetrates evil, and that evil exceeds beyond the din, you know, the mishpat, the gzeira of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Even though, again, there's always going to be a cheshbon, you know, in the divine system of justice, there's a perfect system. But in this case, where God decided for whatever reason to lower the punishment a bit, then the recipient, who's now in the process of tshuva, he realizes he messed up, and now he wants to get the full brunt of the punishment to set himself straight, then the decree itself is not going to engender so much ava. And I think there's an additional idea here that the Ein Hayah is deriving from the Zohar, that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes a gzera against the sinner, and within the framework of that decree, the punishment is going to come from a Baal Bechira, you know, there's going to be a human being enter stage here that's going to battle against this sinner and cause him evil, then it's very possible that this individual, who is going to be, in a sense, the messenger of Hashem to bring about this punishment and fulfill the divine decree, if this individual is a Baal Bechira, there may be some element that goes beyond the Choku Mishpat, that goes beyond a punishment that's even harsher, a certain increment to the punishment above and beyond that which strictly according to the laws of justice would be the appropriate gzera, the appropriate onesh for the chote, to punish his crime. Because now the Baal Bechira steps in and his ra is going to be sometimes even greater than the original gzera of HaKadosh Baruch, because he has freedom of choice. Here's where David HaMelech is very anxious, because the extra hosafa, the extra increment, is not part of the gzera el yonah, it's not part of the divine decree, and it's not the measure for measure punishment that he should experience. David HaMelech thinks that maybe the evil that Hashem is bringing upon David, and he's already prophesied to that effect, is going to come from an eved or a mamzer, and there won't be any room for mercy on the part of the Eved and the mamzer. There's going to be a bechira here that the Eved and the mamzer is going to create an increment and go beyond the divine decree. David's not happy about that. You know, he's more than happy to accept the divine decree insofar as that decree fits measure for measure the severity of his avera and the necessity for kapara of his avera. But he's not at all happy to be borea more than the chov, not just 1,000, but he has to pay 1,500 because of the fact that the the shliach, if you will, who's going to vanquish David and cause suffering to David, is going to add a little bit of his own above and beyond the divine decree. And therefore, when David finds out that the divine decree will be implemented not by some eved or mamzer, but rather by his own son, and stam brachayis al ava, then he certainly understands that the divine decree is up to a certain point and not beyond. There's no other element here of, you know, the shliach, as I call him, the agent to bring about the punishment is going to go through his bechira beyond. No. The agent in this case, which will be his own son, will have compassion on his father. And therefore, whatever ra, whatever evil he will bring upon his father, it will be exactly commensurate to the original gzeira of Hashem, the divine decree, and not beyond. And as far as the divine decree of punishment, David is happy, he accepts it with love. The only problem is he's afraid that there'll be a hosafa, there'll be an extra increment above and beyond the gzeir el yonah through the bechira of man. That's what was the masa, so to speak. That was the heavy burden of Chovas Piran that was weighing heavily on David's shoulders, the shtar chov. And how happy was David when he found out that no, that it's going to be his own son, that there's no extra element of increasing the punishment beyond the gzeir el yonah through bechira chavshis. No, the son has compassion, and whatever he brings about, whatever punishment, that's exactly what was originally planned and arranged by Hashem in his divine decree, and it's all for the good, and it's going to bring about a kapara for David. David's response is mizmar leDavid. He's happy, and he's willing to accept the gzeir of HaKadosh Baruch Hu with Av. All right, we'll stop here.